You ever hear about the longest fighter intercept mission of the Second World War? 435 miles over open ocean at wavetop height, no radio, no margin for error, and one target. One man. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one reads like a thriller, except every word of it happened. April 18, 1943. Guadalcanal. 16 P-38 Lightnings from the 339th Fighter Squadron sat on the strip at Henderson Field. Engines ticking in the pre-dawn dark. The pilots had been briefed the night before on a mission so secret that most of them didn't fully understand what they were about to do until that morning. Their target was Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, the commander-in-chief of the Japanese Combined Fleet, the architect of Pearl Harbor. And American codebreakers knew exactly where he'd be and exactly when he'd be there. See, the Navy's cryptanalysts at Station Hypo had cracked the Japanese naval code, JN-25, They intercepted a message detailing Yamamoto's inspection tour of forward bases in the Solomon Islands. The message laid out his itinerary with Japanese military precision. Departure from Rabaul at 0600, arrival at the airfield on Bougainville at 0945 aircraft type. Number of escort fighters, exact route, it was almost too good to be true. And that made the decision agonizing. If the Americans shot down Yamamoto, the Japanese might figure out their codes had been broken. That intelligence advantage was winning the war in the Pacific, was killing one admiral worth losing the ability to read every message. The Japanese Navy sent, the debate went all the way up to the Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, and there are accounts that suggest President Roosevelt himself gave the nod. The decision came back in one word. Get him. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now here's where it gets interesting. The P-38 Lightning was the only fighter in the American inventory with the range to pull this off. Twin engines, twin booms, that distinctive profile. The Lockheed engineers had designed it as a high-altitude interceptor, but down in the South Pacific it had become the long arm of the Army Air Forces. Even so, 435 miles to the intercept point meant every drop of fuel mattered. The ground crews hung 310-gallon drop tanks under the wings, the big ones, and the pilots would have to fly a dogleg course over open water to avoid detection by Japanese coast watchers on the islands below. Major John Mitchell planned the mission. He worked out the heading, the timing, the fuel burn with a compass, a chart, and a pencil. No radar, no GPS, no ground-based navigation aids. Just dead reckoning over the Pacific Ocean at 50 feet above the waves where there's nothing to give you a position fix. If his math was off by even a few degrees, they'd miss the intercept entirely, and probably run out of gas on the way home. Four of the 16 P-38s were designated the killer flight. Their job was to climb, engage, and destroy Yamamoto's transport aircraft. The other 12 were top cover, there to deal with the escort zeros. The killer flight was led by Captain Tom Lanfear, with Lieutenant Rex Barber on his wing, and Lieutenants Besby Holmes and Ray Hine as the second element. Holmes had trouble with his drop tanks and spent precious time trying to get them to release, which effectively took him out of the initial attack. They launched into the morning haze, 16 lightnings in loose formation, skimming the whitecaps at what the pilots later described as an altitude you could measure in feet, not hundreds of feet. Radio silence. 2 hours and 9 minutes over water with nothing to look at but the horizon and your instruments. 2 hours and 9 minutes to think about what you're flying into. And Mitchell's navigation was perfect, just perfect at 0934. The flight spotted two Mitsubishi G4M Betty bombers descending toward the Bougainville coast exactly where they were supposed to be. Exactly on time. 6-0 fighters flew escort above them. Yamamoto was in the lead bomber. The killer flight punched off their drop tanks and started climbing. What happened next has been debated for 80 years, and I mean debated hotly. Lanfear and Barber both claimed the kill on Yamamoto's aircraft, and the controversy followed both men for the rest of their lives. Here's what we know. Lanfear later said he pulled up into a near-vertical climb, turned into the escorts, shot down one of the Zeros, then dove on the lead Betty and hit it with a deflection shot that tore its wing off. Barber's account was different. He said he came in from behind the lead bomber, close to within a few dozen yards, and poured fire directly into the fuselage and engines. He said he saw pieces come off the aircraft before it plunged into the jungle canopy. Rex Barber's account has generally held up better under scrutiny. Japanese records of the crash site, the angle of impact, the damage to the aircraft, most of it lines up with an attack from the rear, not a deflection shot from the side. A 1991 expedition to the crash site in the Bougainville jungle found wreckage patterns consistent with Barber's description, but the Air Force officially credited the kill to both men for decades, and it wasn't until years after both pilots had passed that a review board gave primary credit to Barber. The second Betty, carrying Yamamoto's chief of staff, Vice Admiral Motomi Ugaki, was hit by Barber on a second pass or possibly by Holmes after he finally got into the fight. That aircraft crashed into the sea just offshore. Ugaki survived, badly injured. He'd go on to command the Kamikaze Corps in the final months of the war. Yamamoto didn't survive. When Japanese search parties reached the crash site the next morning, they found his body still strapped into his seat, thrown clear of the wreckage into the jungle. He was upright against a tree, in full dress uniform, his hand still gripping the hilt of his katana. A surgeon determined that he'd been killed by two 50 caliber rounds, one through the shoulder, one through the jaw, either of which would have been fatal. The man who planned Pearl Harbor was gone. Lieutenant Ray Hine didn't make it home. His P-38 was last seen trailing smoke over the water. He was the only American loss on the mission.
Now step back and think about what had to go right for this to work. The codebreakers had to crack the message. The intelligence had to reach the right people. The decision had to be made at the highest level of government. John Mitchell had to plot a dead reckoning course over 400 miles of ocean and hit a moving target within a one-minute window. The Lightnings had to carry enough fuel to get there, fight, and get home. And the killer flight had to find two bombers in a sky full of nothing and shoot down the right one on the first pass. Any single failure in that chain and Yamamoto flies on to Bougainville, has his inspection tour, and goes home to Rabaul. Back when avgas was cheap and airspace was free, we used to talk about seat-of-the-pants flying as if it were something casual. But Mitchell's navigation on that mission was seat-of-the-pants at the highest level. Dead reckoning across featureless ocean with a compass that's swinging in turbulence, maintaining a heading for over 2 hours while your brain does the math on wind drift and ground speed, and arriving at the exact right spot in the sky at the exact right second. That's airmanship of the first order. That's piloting. The P-38 itself deserves a moment here. The Lightning was a strange, beautiful machine. Kelly Johnson's design, Lockheed Burbank's pride, two Allison V-1710 engines, counter-rotating props, a center nacelle packed with a 20mm cannon, and 450 caliber machine guns all firing straight ahead. No convergence pattern to worry about. You point the nose and everything hits the same spot. At distances under 300 yards, a one-second burst from a P-38 could cut a bomber in half. It was fast, it climbed well at altitude. But it was heavy on the controls and it couldn't turn with a zero in a low-speed dogfight. The smart P-38 pilots, the ones who survived, learned to fight in the vertical. Dive, shoot, climb away. Never slow down. Never try to turn with them. The ones who forgot that lesson didn't come home.
Richard Bong flew the Lightning. Tommy McGuire flew the Lightning. Charles Lindbergh flew combat missions in the Lightning as a civilian technical representative, which is a story for another day that still raises eyebrows. In the Pacific Theater, the P-38 was the long-range killer that the island-hopping campaign demanded. No other fighter could go as far, stay as long, and hit as hard. After the Yamamoto mission, the pilots were ordered not to talk about it. The secret of the broken codes had to be protected. The official cover story attributed the intercept to Coast Watcher intelligence, a fiction that held up for decades. The men who flew the mission couldn't tell their families, couldn't talk to the press, couldn't even talk to other pilots about what they'd done. Mitchell didn't receive the Medal of Honor, though many argued he deserved one. Lanfear and Barber received Navy Crosses. The full story didn't emerge until the code-breaking secrets were declassified in the 1970s and 80s. By then, the argument over who shot down Yamamoto had taken on a life of its own. Lanfear was vocal and public about his claim. Barber was quieter but persistent. Their supporters divided into camps that sometimes turned bitter. It's a strange footnote to one of the most remarkable missions of the war that the two men who pulled it off spent their later years fighting each other over credit, but set that aside and look at what they accomplished together. 18 men, 16 airplanes, a compass heading, and 2 hours of nerve, they removed the most dangerous strategic mind in the Japanese military. Yamamoto's replacement, Admiral Minichi Koga, was competent but cautious, and he died in a plane crash himself the following year. The combined fleet never again had leadership with the audacity and vision that Yamamoto brought. Whether his death shortened the war is something historians will argue forever. That the mission itself was one of the most precise, daring, and consequential fighter operations ever flown is not. This one drew from Carol Glines' book Attack on Yamamoto, Dan Hampton's excellent work on the mission, and Warbird restoration records from the Pacific Aviation Museum. Fly safe, and remember to look up once in a while. Some of those old Lightnings are still out there. RadioHangar.com, I'm Taildragger. See you next time.